Welcome to Technovation, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, president of Meta Strategy, advisor to technology executives, Forbes columnist, book author, and your host. Each episode of Technovation features insights from top executives and thought leaders at the intersection of business, technology, and innovation. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please subscribe so you don't miss a thing. Thank you. My guest this week is Paul Clark. Paul's the Chief Technology Officer of Ocado, the world's largest online-only grocery retailer. In his role, Paul heads up Ocado Technology, whose 950-plus engineers develop the cutting-edge technology that powers Ocado's operations and the Ocado Smart platform. Given its vision of powering the future of retail through sustained disruptive technology innovation, Paul has guided Ocado to differentiate itself by focusing not on how fast they can innovate, but on how fast they can innovate their system for innovation. In this interview, Paul discusses the broad and deep technology estate that has enabled Ocado's online grocery business to operate with scale, sustainability, and profitability. Through a focused but balanced approach to innovation, the company has developed a unique end-to-end operating solution for online grocery retail that includes massive automated warehouses and an e-commerce fulfillment and logistics platform. Ocado is now making its technology available to other retailers through the B2B-focused Ocado Solutions arm. We also discuss Ocado's roadmap for a frictionless customer experience, the advantages of its business model, its culture and disruptive innovation, and a variety of other topics.
Paul Clark, welcome to Technovation. It's great to speak with you today.
Thanks very much.
Paul, I wonder if we could begin with an overview of your organization. You are the Chief Technology of Ocado Technology. And I wondered if you could talk a bit about that organization, the Ocado Group, more generally speaking, for those who may not be familiar with it.
Sure. So Ocado is the largest online-only grocery retailer in the world. We operate in the UK. We've been doing what we do for over 18 years now. Obviously, a lot of things have changed and evolved during that time. But our vision has stayed the same, which is really to use a large amount of technology and automation to do online grocery scalably, sustainably, and profitably. And the nature of grocery in terms of its sort of item value and margins means that really, in order to do that, you know, technology really is the only answer in our view. We have a very different sort of business model maybe from other companies. You know, we use huge automated warehouses, and we build all the technology that powers our end-to-end e-commerce fulfillment and logistics platform ourselves. And now we're in the business of making that technology available to other large bricks and mortar grocery retailers around the world who effectively want to do what we do, but who don't want to build all of that technology themselves, let alone take 18 years to evolve all the know-how in order to do it.
And speaking of that technology, I've read, Paul, that it's really not only cutting edge, but it is pretty expansive to include real-time control systems, robotics, computer vision systems, machine learning and AI, simulation, data science, forecasting and routing systems, inference engines, et cetera. And I wonder, as you mentioned, part of the answer, I suppose, as to how you've grown this and done it in a homegrown fashion as opposed to buying off the shelf or partnering with a broader ecosystem of partners delivering the technology for you. But I'm curious if you can provide a bit of an overview as to the way in which this technology has evolved.
So we've always really built the software ourselves. Right from the start. I mean, I suppose in the very early days, we tried gluing together a bunch of solutions sort of that we bought off the shelf. And we quickly proved to ourselves that although it sort of worked, it didn't scale. It wasn't of sufficient kind of robustness and quality. And really the only way that we were going to do this, you know, was to build it ourselves. And that's because, you know, online grocery is very different from other kinds of online retail. There are all sorts of things you have to contend with to do with, you know, temperature and the short shelf life of items and the fact that one item may crush another. And as I said already, the kind of the item price being much lower And all of these kind of factors and many more mean that, you know, doing online grocery is very different. So there was no template, you know, for doing this. We had to come up with that ourselves and then build the technology, as I say, initially the software, but more recently, we've now also moved into the hardware business. You know, the robots that now whiz around our newest warehouses, you know, are our own, and you know, we own the IP, and we are manufacturing those, you know, to run in our facilities.
And that's very interesting. And I wonder, in developing this technology yourself, obviously that means you need to have a fantastic team that is able to do so. It's one of the limiting factors in many organizations as they contemplate the sort of innovation that you've undertaken. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about the methods you have used, as well as the skills you have hired for to enable all of this.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're right. I mean, we have a disproportionately large engineering team in Ocado for the size of business that we are. And that's because really, although obviously we're a retailer and a technology business, and it's that blend of the two that has got us to where we are, because, you know, we can drive a lot of the innovation and the requirements from our own retail businesses, build the technology, and then kind of put it back into harm's way in our own businesses, and that kind of keeps us honest. So that's helped drive the kind of the whole innovation machine. But we've had to grow a very large engineering team. It's currently kind of bumping up at around sort of probably 1,400 engineers on the software side, and maybe, you know, we include the hardware side, we're over 2,000, and that's growing all the time. Finding that talent is definitely not easy. And we have a number of development centers, you know, in mainland Europe as well as the one we have in the UK. We're constantly, you know, on the hunt for new talent. We look for it in unusual places, and we also do think very carefully about how the kind of the innovation machine works, because it's of course a lot of it is about the people, but it's also about the culture and the mindset and the kind of the methodology that you have around innovation. And I think that is one of the other sort of differentiating and critical pieces of the puzzle within our business, in terms of how we're constantly evolving that kind of innovation machine as we go forward, both in terms of as the company matures, but also as we change our kind of our business in other ways and you know, create new products or think of, you know, new ways to exploit the intellectual property that we've developed. And that process of talent management and leadership, you know, constantly kind of adding to the gene pool, it's a very nonlinear one. You know, I think it's an art form, not a science. You have to be prepared, you know, to do some things which in many cases beforehand make no real sense, but you just have to trust your intuition that they're going to lead to something exciting. And once you've done that enough times and proved to yourself that it works, then, you know, you have the confidence to keep on doing that. But it's inherently kind of nonlinear, and I often describe it as being a bit like playing extreme nonlinear snakes and ladders. You know, some of the most exciting outcomes come at the bottom of what feel like snakes. So you have to kind of tolerate that uncertainty, especially as a disruptor, because, you know, you're often having to do things that, you know, nobody's asked you to do, but where you're really just, you know, trusting your vision.
Very interesting. You referenced a methodology, and I don't know how literally you meant that. You meant reference, of course, also that it's nonlinear. But I wonder, are there steps that you can reference that the organization goes through as it directs its innovation activities, recognizing that the exploration process, the process itself will lead to various forks, which may lead to conclusions that were unexpected at the beginning of the journey. But I wonder what you can share from a methodology perspective.
Yes, I mean, I maybe methodology isn't quite the right word. I think it's, I think there's probably, I think you need multiple different innovation pathways in order to sort of skin the innovational cat, if you like, because, you know, there's a lot of our innovation that happens within our kind of core engineering teams. It's just part and parcel of what we do. And a lot of that, you know, might well fall into what other companies would consider to be R&D. But as a disruptor, it is just much more business as usual. Then we have the kind of the business funded R&D streams, you know, research streams like sort of, you know, robotics and vision systems and simulation and quite a number of the different applications of AI and machine learning that go into building, you know, our future products. And then we have a kind of advanced research, or as we call it, kind of 10X department. And they are off placing kind of innovational bets that perhaps the business wouldn't want to place, but which we need to do in order to make sure that, you know, we stay edgy, that we stay disruptive. And because of that nonlinear nature, you know, you can't neatly just go, you know, from A to B to C. You have to be prepared to take some flyers and including doing some stuff, as I said already, makes maybe no sense on paper, but just may lead to something interesting. And you have to balance that, obviously. You know, if we just did nothing but that, we would potentially lose our way. But it is a balancing act between the sort of the more obvious evolution of what you've done before, you know, the research, the business funded research, and then this kind of more sort of out there kind of research activity that go on in our 10X department. And in between those are kind of some not watertight compartments, but I think you do need different kinds of mindsets or methodologies in those different compartments, different ways of working, different tools, different success criteria, different timescales, you know, and therefore you know it's not a one size fits all. And I think that's really what I was getting at when I referred to methodology. It's probably a set of different methodologies.
Very interesting. You mentioned at the outset, of course, that you're the world's largest online-only grocer, but that you also partner with others. And I wonder what that pathway was from developing your own solution, your own retail service, obviously grocery retail service, to partnering with others who, as you point out, probably recognize that your lead was such that they wouldn't be able to compete head-to-head. And what that process was like, you know, how early in the evolution of the company was the decision to partner with would-be competitors leveraging your technology?
I wasn't actually in the business when it was founded. I joined in 2006, so, you know, I've been there for a little over 12 years. But my understanding is that really that vision that one day we would aim to make our technology available to other retailers was part of the sort of the founding mission, along with the idea of using technology and automation to do, you know, online grocery scalably and profitably. And so it's not a new idea, but clearly before we could do that, we had to evolve a solution for ourselves. We had to prove it worked and, you know, to become sufficiently successful, you know, in the UK, you know, growing at the rate that we've been growing, you know, double digit growth for quite a number of years now, in a very difficult industry, particularly, you know, as it has been in the UK with, you know, up until recently, food deflation. That's been a great kind of annealing process, if you like, in terms of proving our solution and forcing us to constantly evolve it. But having done that, then, you know, we got to the point where we felt we were ready to start our kind of B2B activities and start making that technology platform available. Initially, we made it available to, you know, one of the big four bricks and mortar grocery businesses in the UK called Morrisons, and having got them live in January 2014, we set about the process of building a completely new platform that was designed from the get-go to be, if you like, one that, you know, had the necessary kind of attributes for providing it to multiple retailers, you know, around the world. And that's a combination of our end-to-end platform running in the cloud, but also the Swarm robotics technology for building our automated warehouses. And that's what we call the Ocado Smart Platform. And now, you know, we've recently, you know, been off signing deals with quite a number of different retailers around the world, including most recently a very large deal with Kroger, you know, in the US. But it's a that's an ongoing process. You know, we're going to keep on going. We're in the platform business now, so we're now a retailer, a technology business, and a platform business. You know, and it's not going to stop there, because, you know, as we've sort of hinted in our most recent results announcement, you know, the story doesn't stop there. There are lots of opportunities to take, you know, our technologies and do other exciting things with them, and we'll get to that too. So I think that's the nature of our business, is that you know, we never rest on our laurels. We're always trying to think of, you know, what the next big ride in the theme park is going to be.
Well, I wonder if you could take a moment and talk about the customer journey from finding Ocado through to the order process, the fulfillment process, the delivery process, with an eye towards some of the technology we've already begun to discuss. Maybe not comprehensively, but I would love to get a snapshot of that customer journey and the interaction with the various aspects of technology that we've described.
Sure. So our customer journey as an online grocery retailer obviously starts with our customers placing their orders online, either on our web shop or mobile apps. We then pick and pack those orders in our huge automated warehouses, and then we deliver them to our customers' kitchen tables using our own delivery fleet in one-hour delivery slots. And along that kind of pipeline, if you like, into people's homes, there's all manner of applications of different technologies, including a lot of AI and machine learning, IoT, cloud, obviously, robotics, and many others. And sort of coming back to the sharp end, you know, we're using sort of AI and machine learning to help take friction out of the process, because, you know, most customers in our experience, you know, don't jump out of bed in the mornings and say, you know, hooray, today is my online grocery shopping day. It's just something that they, you know, they would like to get done as quickly as possible. And so making our interfaces, you know, smart and adaptable is really important, adaptable to different shopping styles. You know, do people want to shop from previous orders, from favorites? Do they want to shop by browsing, by searching? Or do they just want to click a button and have us work out, based on what they've bought before and what we think they've run out of, what they would want in their basket right now? And they can do that too. And if they forget anything, you know, we remind them in the whole kind of checkout walk of all the things that they might have missed, the things we think they've run out of, the offers that they haven't completed. You know, if they want to eat more healthily, we can offer them substitutes that might be healthier. There's all sorts of different stages to that process, but it's really all about, you know, friction reduction. But it's also about, you know, inspiring them to shop from the 50,000 different items that we sell. In our experience, most people shop from around 200, 250 items. And so it's about creating the peripheral vision, if you like, a bit like you do when you run down, you know, the aisle of a conventional supermarket, you know, with your trolley and spot things as you're going past. There's a way to do that online, but there's obviously things that you can't do in a physical store. You can create different lenses. You can let people shop, you know, through an organic lens, through a gluten-free lens, through a Swedish lens or an American lens or an organic lens. And so instead of the kind of the physical store, which I would describe as a one-size-fits-nobody, you know, you can create any number of virtual stores for customers, but also adapt to their different kind of shopping agendas. You know, are they doing a monthly shop, a weekly shop, or they're just buying a few ingredients for a meal in tonight? So that's the kind of, you know, we're doing a lot with voice there, where we have applications of machine learning around the whole forecasting side, working out what customers are going to be buying, you know, looking for that sweet spot that maximizes, you know, availability and freshness for customers, but at the same time, you know, minimizing stock cover and wastage. And so that's a critical part of what we do. Coming into our warehouses, there's the sort of the swarm robotics that I've mentioned earlier, you know, these thousands of robots whizzing around collecting our customers' groceries, controlled by, you know, a sophisticated sort of machine learning air traffic control system, communicating with these robots in what is now the densest mobile network in the world, overseen by a kind of a healthcare system for these swarms of robots that make sure we keep them in tip-top shape, you know, spotting if a particular robot needs to come in, you know, to have its battery pack changed, or if it's not accelerating or decelerating as fast as it used to. And then beyond the warehouse, we get to the kind of the last mile. So optimizing, you know, the thousands of routes that we drive each day, both in terms of providing oversight of those routes as they're happening, but also taking the data from those routes and feeding it back into the routing systems to help optimize, you know, the routes that we'll be driving tomorrow and in the days to come. But there are many other applications, you know, of robotics and AI and other technologies, you know, that we could drill into. And looking ahead to the future, you know, we're developing new robotic systems for things like picking and packing of groceries. That's quite far advanced. We are building new kinds of robotic gripper to cope with all the different form factors of the items that we sell. We're even building a humanoid maintenance robot that can collaborate with our human engineers to make the maintenance of our facilities, you know, even more scalable. The technologies involved in that solution will have lots of spin-out applications. And then finally, or not finally, but finally, and probably the ones that I can actually talk about, you know, we're very interested in the whole area of driverless deliveries. And, you know, we've done some trials in that area, and we have some very exciting plans that we're hatching for how to take those forward. So, you know, the whole future, if you like, of mobility, in terms of how you transport, you know, atoms around, I think is going to be a really exciting area going forward, whether those be human atoms, groceries, or anything else.
As you mentioned earlier in the conversation, Paul, yours is a business that was that is remarkably thin in its margins, especially you know, from across retail. It has enormous complexity in supply chain in the various stages of the customer journey that you described as well. Obviously, you're dealing with goods that have expiration dates in most cases, et cetera. A great deal of complexity, but I think I hear in the answer you've just given, as well as across several of the threads pulled through this conversation, that it's actually in many ways the technology that has helped you, you know, create a bit more space, create maybe a little bit more margin than competitors, maybe not even just a little bit, and helped you fund the significant R&D engine that you have. It would strike me actually that maybe that is also a competitive advantage you have over traditional retailers as well, in having an ability to do a number of things more efficiently than they can, and therefore have more money to put to the very R&D that leads to the technologies for the further improvements. Is that a fair hypothesis?
Yeah, I think that's spot on. I think there are many advantages, if you like, that come from this business model that is centered around these huge, you know, automated facilities, because they let you do some things that you can't do if you're picking in store. You know, they allow us to range more items. They allow us to drive much greater efficiency, as you've suggested, into the whole fulfillment process. They allow us to operate at a fraction of the wastage levels that, you know, you would have in a conventional supermarket. I mean, we our economic wastage is around the kind of 0.75%. Our actual food wastage is 1.5 orders of magnitude smaller than that, at about 0.02%. So we basically only throw away 1 in every 6,000 products. We could give our customers what they ordered almost every time, because basically either we have it in stock now, or we, once you said you want it, we will forward order it for you. And pretty much the only time we would ever have to substitute is if one of our suppliers lets us down and we don't happen to have the stock cover. So, you know, that order accuracy is another attribute. We can, as well as having an amazing range, we can also work with speciality suppliers who couldn't get shelf space on a normal supermarket, in a normal supermarket, perhaps because of competition or the fact that the wastage levels as they're getting started would be too high. But by putting all, you know, their inventory in one of our facilities, we can give them that shelf space. And in fact, we've given birth to quite a number of new companies that kind of got started with Ocado and then have gone on to sell in conventional stores. So we're very proud of that too. So, you know, I could go on, but the point is, there are some inherent advantages to the centralized fulfillment model. And that's, of course, why, you know, the large retailers who we've signed deals with, you know, around the world, you know, they've, many cases, they've tried, you know, picking in stores. They know that, you know, it might work in certain areas of their geography, but there are, you know, some inherent advantages to our model. And that's why, you know, they want to add our technology into the mix to allow them to do what we do. So it's kind of chalk and cheese, if you like, between picking in store and doing it in this highly automated way.
Indeed. Well, Paul Clark, it's been a fascinating conversation. I appreciate you taking time on the forum on World Class IT and providing an overview of your business and how it has evolved. It's been a great conversation.
An absolute pleasure. Thank you very much indeed.